showcase. Hello, sorry everyone about the technical screw up there. I thought we were online, I thought we'd gone live, but we actually hadn't. So the three of us have been sitting here chatting for the last 5 minutes, blissfully unaware that we weren't talking to anyone. So I'm sorry everyone, but nonetheless, here we are with the final stream for this evening, and it is with Blood Satellite, and rather Dimes and Judas from Blood Satellite. So welcome finally to Millennial.
Thank you. First of all, I am pleased as punch to be here. Second of all, don't feel bad about this stuff, because I've often said that in my world, the world I envision, everybody has a podcast and no one listens to podcasts.
Someone says at least it was only 5 minutes. Indeed, it could have been disastrous. Imagine if I hadn't thought to check Odyssey and we were just chatting for an hour. Fucking hell. Anyway, all right. So, Dimes, do you want to tell everyone briefly about Blood Satellite? Well, start with the title, but we'll go through that again.
Oh, okay. So just to recap briefly, and I'll try and even shorten it more this time, because a reminder, this is a dumb story. So it starts with myself and Judas, my intrepid co-host. We've been friends since high school. And the name came from my recollection. He's got a different story that he'll tell you in a second. It probably lies, but mine, which is right, was that it was a kind of an inside joke in our friend group, where the joke was that we're always talking about doomsday shit, like everybody around here talking about end of the world scenario. What would happen is if we kept our blood alive, and we could do that by keeping it in orbit around Earth. Which is funny, because that doesn't make sense. That is stupid. That is what the fuck. But then I realized later that after we picked that name as kind of an inside thing, and it sounds cool, frankly, it could also be inferred as kind of a blood and soil thing, which I welcome all interpretations, all retroactive stories about how this title came. But then there was also the implication that it could be violence related, that a blood satellite in forensics refers to like a little blood splatter outside of a main one. And I didn't want to be misinterpreted as calling for violence. So it's not that. I promise you, it is just retarded. Now, Judas, you got a whole pack of lies that you're going to come out with. So go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm not entirely making it up, but it feels like it does change every time I tell it. But I just remember it was you and me and my now wife and a couple of our friends wandering around. We must have been 17 or 18, fucking around in Toronto and making some joke about surveillance and satellites watching us, and similar story. And yes, it wound up being at some point that we were talking about the idea that they'd have our blood up there for some reason to control us, or some goofball conspiracy theory. I just always thought it was funny that it's that old and the meaning has changed so many times, and we've used it so often for so many other things, and only now it's essentially become a brand associated with this podcast that we do. But for us, it's a catch-all name for our friend group we've been using for at least 20 years. So,
and then the next question people have is, well, what's the dollar sign about? To which I would retort, that is a poor person question.
Okay, so now when to tell people about what Blood Satellite is, the actual channel.
Okay, well, it's mainly a podcast. It lives primarily in the audio form right now. You can catch the episodes on bloodsatellite.ca. It started off as a podcast. It's grown in duration over time. And now we also release video clips that's released on Odyssey. And we just got back on YouTube as well. And that's almost been growing as a more in-depth appendage. I'm adding more and more detail and more context and more work into it. So they're almost becoming like little short films. But the purpose of the show, and Judas, if you also want to weigh in on this too, but I mean, it started off, I think, for me, because I had an appreciation of radio, because I am a boomer-brained white millennial. So I liked things like Howard Stern and Opie and Anthony, things like that. So I liked it. I liked the format. And I guess at the core of it, I thought that you know, we're very politically active. We have ideas. We have these thoughts on things. And I thought the best way to develop these thoughts is to articulate them by saying them out loud,
right,
and kind of hashing them out rather than just living in your head or living in, you know, little things that you write and keep to yourself. And it's through that you will reveal bad ideas. And yeah, then we also like to joke around, and we thought we were funny, and it turns out we're right.
We're awesome.
Excellent.
I was gonna say when we started, we've been doing this for at least 3 years, there were four of us in the beginning, and I don't know if those episodes are actually up. A lot of them have been taken down because they're quite bad, but there were four of us, and part of it was almost like you said, you love radio and the idea of this, but we're four distant friends. I was living in China at the time, and we had a chance to talk and kind of shoot the shit about this stuff. And then it evolved. By the time it was just you and I, for various reasons, the other two guys left. And then you came to this idea. You were the one always with the paperwork and the plan who came up with this idea that if you're reading these books and you want to tell me about them, if you just, you're essentially, I haven't read the book. You're explaining the book to me, and the process of you explaining it to me and me being a springboard to bounce back at you with some feedback is not only a better way for us to understand it, but to explain it to the layman who hasn't read the book. So that was something that we seized on, and that's been our format, I think, for at least a year, that we kind of shoot the shit for a while and we talk about some topical stuff, but then you've always got a book. And then recently you've added in the interviews, which I think are really fantastic. I'm just giving props to Dimes here, the way that he has been tying all of the selection and topic for the interviews into the book topics. And it's great. I love our format. Here I'm talking about our show as if I'm a listener, but I love it. Yeah.
No, but it's part of a larger snowballing project. And a lot of the guests that we'll have on, for example, if we're speaking about phenomenology, well, there's a lot, like Tyler Hamilton, for example, he's a phenomenologist. So we'll bring him in. So oftentimes we'll bring in people to kind of build on the things that we had talked about before. Like one of my favorites was when we just had Dennis Bouvard on, who is the author of Anthropomorphics by Imperium Press. And he was a bit of a hard guy to get. But then once we established the premise of the show, I explained it to Judas in a way that, you know, he understands it, then the audience understands it. Then we can really get into the meat of it with the people who have pioneered some of these ideas. And that's, You know, the funny thing is the reviewing of the book started off as a project. Like all great things, it started off very stupidly. So we just decided at some point along the way where I'm like, you know what, let's go. I'm going to read what we know as the meme books. So the meme books would be The Bell Curve, Culture of Critique, stuff that like everyone talks about, but a lot of people haven't actually sat down and read. And we've kind of carried that through to the books now, for example, and I'm going to get some people clapping at this. When I hear something like K-lines, what's a K-line? And I have to read The Society of Mind by Marvin Minsky just to get it's curiosity leads it. And then everything starts interconnecting. So you actually, over the course of time, you get an interesting tapestry of divergent ideas that we can kind of call back to each other. And that to me, that's what keeps me doing it. That's what, like, it never feels like work to me. There is, after all these years, it's a genuine energy that this is the main thing I like doing.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, I can sense your enthusiasm just as we're talking right now. And I think it's great when it was similar with Dave Martell last night representing the Biz Archives, where you can tell that he's doing something that he loves doing. And I think that something that, I mean, it's great if anyone can do that, spend time doing something that they love doing and that is beneficial to other people. Even better if you can make a living from it. That's obviously the dream, I think.
Those people too, because we talked to Dave too. I mean, he's a guy where being around him is like taking a shot of steroids to your own body. So being around those people is like really energizing. You know, you can feel the passion. And Biz Archives, I have nothing but nice things to say about that.
For sure.
Anyway, I don't want to go off talking about all these other guys talking about themselves.
Well, the thing is, our sphere is often very intense and full of people talking about depressing topics, and it's also full of a lot of there's an unusual preponderance of antisocial types, in our sphere, simply because of the nature of it, that we're going against the mainstream. But what that means is that there's often a very combative atmosphere. And so I think it's nice when enthusiasm kind of dissolves all of that to some extent. If you love what you're doing and it's not draining you, then that in turn energizes other people who listen to it.
It is. And one thing, you know, some people think I'm a bit too optimistic or sentimental when I say this, but I'm here in this scene because I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. I am consistently impressed and energized by the people I talk to, not only the ones we have on our show, but many of the people you've interviewed. You know, this, as people are going to make fun of me for saying this, I'm sure, but I'm a big boy when I say that I think this thing of ours has some of the most interesting minds, I think, in the entire online space, period. I think this is, I know Mike from Imperium Press has talked about this. You know, he shares my sentimentality when he says this thing that's happening right now will be looked upon in the future as a very interesting historical moment. And there's no shortage of talent. There's no shortage of fascinating minds. Some of the most interesting people I've ever met have been on here. So when people say, you know, they hate their fan base, they're tired of this, I'm like, you should log off. The reason I never log off is because I fucking love it here. I'm having the time of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a certain tenacity to it. Like, people who stick around here, you have to be pretty adaptable. It's like Canada, right? It's like a harsh environment, and you become hardened, and the people that are left after a while are the clever and resourceful.
I like what you said there, because in a way we are all Canadian.
We're all Canadian deep down. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're online, you're Canadian.
All right. I mean, that's an interesting way to look at it, but it does get us to what we were planning to mainly talk about here, which is, Canada and the trucker protest. And just the age of Trudeau. I mean, this came up with at least, I think, well, definitely with the course of empire, but I think there was another one where it was relevant as well. How would you even start this topic from your point of view as people who are obviously very much immersed in that country and all your lives? How would you introduce it? Because I'm imagining that when you were kids, Canada was, it felt like a different place. What would you say about that?
I would agree. It is a big question. Like, when Canada, when I was younger, it's different because I think the spirit of the times changes how we view our own politicization. So some people will say, like, oh, politics just seemed different back in the day. I'm not sure if that's the case. I'd have to talk to someone who's older. But, you know, when I was younger, you know what's funny? That a lot of what I think the bad things that are pillars of Canadian identity have remained. And I'll say a lot of nice things about Canada in a second and Canadians. I'm going to say a couple bad things first. So one thing that's carried over time is many Canadians, probably not the people who listen to us or this way politically, but a lot of them will define themselves in opposition to Americans. And almost in a very uppity, snooty way, which I've never liked. I didn't like it as a kid. I don't like it now. Every American I've met has been great. But Canada, in grasping for an identity to hold on to, it will kind of push itself away from America and say, oh, with all those crazy Yanks down there. Those are real words that will come out of a Canadian's mouth. Like, those Yanks, you know, as if we're like that much different or different at all. So that has essentially remained the same. I think the tone and tenor of the conservative movement has essentially remained the same, for better or worse. See, what's interesting about Canada is, in many ways, it seems stuck in stasis. And Judas, I'd like to know what you think about that as well. But you get this phenomenon here in Canada where Trudeau just sticks around. It's unreal that even people who like Justin Trudeau, our prime minister, don't seem to really like him. It's very difficult for me to find someone who is adamant about Justin Trudeau. Even the people who vote for him are just kind of doing it in a trance. So it's, there is no joie de vivre and jouissance in anything like that. What do you say about that, Jus? Does anything make sense?
I mean, I think there's an apathy towards politics, and for a lot of people, where, like, the fact that Trudeau was even, I mean, I'm not sure the election wasn't fraudulent. I think there's a good chance that it was. But there does seem to be, you could call it broad support for his regime, but it's not really support so much as like a milquetoast version of like Trump derangement syndrome, where people are kind of not comfortable with anything right of center. And Trudeau runs the only liberal party, the large one. I should say there's actually three. So he runs the large one, which heads the coalition. So, I mean, we're going to go with that and we're going to go back to our lives, which is, and then I think part of the frustrating thing is so many, it's very polarizing because a lot of the stuff that he does that we viscerally hate are things that the normies, the average citizen, just doesn't seem to care about. It's not that it doesn't hurt them or that it helps them. It's just that they don't really care that much. It's odd. I don't know. It's a bad situation to be in.
Yeah, I think in Canada, and maybe people can push back on me in the comments, but I think there's almost a learned helplessness. I see in a lot of Canadians, again, not in the people that we talk to, because there are very, very interesting, you know, movements and upstarts going on up here. But I think for the average Canadian, there is the sense that, you know, you are not a sovereign entity. And to have this thirst for, let's say, revolution, let's say, strong political movements, you know, you think of your France, you think of America, you think these places, that spirit is lacking in Canada. I think it's a spirit that can be crafted and introduced or built or grown. But for the majority of my life, I have not seen it. But there is a Canadian identity. There is sort of the Anglophone, Francophone, frontiersman carving this nation out of the wilderness. It's still mostly wilderness. If you like fucking spooky forest, this is the place for you. It's like Russia in that sense. You have to have a bit of grit. You have to have a bit of, even a lot of the urban people I know have an outdoorsy spirit. The fact that there isn't a very rigid history like you might see in an Ireland, in a Britain, in a Scotland, because it is relatively new, I think that presents opportunities for people, which, you know, we could talk about or not talk about, it depends. But I think there is such a thing as a Canadian nationalist project that is a bit more electrified than maybe some others, or would not have some of the same impediments that others would have, because, and I guess this could lead right into the trucker protest. There's a lot of people who talk about the trucker protest. There's probably going to be a lot of people on this show who talk about the trucker protest. And there's a lot of very smart people. I'm going to try as much as I can not to trod over the ground that other illustrious guests have done. You know, for example, the Distributist had some very, very good points about a lot of things the other day. So I'm trying not to listen to this. I'm not trying to duplicate it and bore people. But the one lesson I think I learned from the trucker protest, this ties into what I was just saying, which is it showed not only the unity that is possible in a truly grassroots way, and you can tell it was grassroots because it was plagued by grifters later. That's how you can tell it's a populist movement, when the vultures can actually succeed. But what it showed was that the weaknesses, in my opinion, the weaknesses of the Canadian state and the Canadian government apparatus, or the managerial class, as many say, because there is no shortage of people who would have loved to drop bombs on that protest. And it was massive. I was there. I saw the protest, the truckers, and they're driving by. It's difficult to wrap your mind around how massive this movement was. But anyway, point being that had they the tools, they would have loved to deploy them against the protesters. They did what they could. They went after the banks, because our banks are pretty good. We have certain things, but our military and our police force are severely lacking. And everyone kind of knows that. And that's for a few different reasons. You know, one would be the thing that's plaguing American militaries right now, which is staffing of certain types of people and certain internal problems and just lack of efficiency. But then the fact that we've never really spent that much on our military. And you're not allowed to get mad at me, because every soldier I know says the exact same thing. Yeah. That's where I get this from. You know, there's certain things that we do, but we just don't have the ability to deploy enough agents and individuals to suppress an uprising of that size. And I think some people will decry it by saying, oh, you just taught the cathedral or the system a new tactic. But I'm like, I see nothing but W's. I see nothing but something that I didn't think could happen in this country. And it gave me a real shot in the arm for what I think is possible. And when I say this, I don't want it to be misconstrued as anything violent, anything destructive or anything like that. But just in this era, seeing something of that size and that magnitude and that effectiveness really show me that other things are possible. And I think any Canadian who's telling you to not be happy about that, you can tell them to fuck right off. So you can go now, Judas.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think in light of the way that it ended, with people's bank accounts being frozen and certain people, essentially like Tamara Leach becoming a political prisoner, there's blood in the water politically now, because we all watched how they didn't have anywhere near enough police resources to do anything while it was happening. The only thing they could do was this backdoor digital retribution after it all ended. And I think we all know the reason that that's what they did isn't some grand strategy, although that's what they'll say. The reason they did that is because it's all they can do. Short of actually sending the military in, which would have been the end for all of us, they couldn't do anything. So it leaves the door open for any future movements. We all know that short of a military intervention, we can do this as many times as we want, and they're never going to arrest all of us because they literally can't. It isn't like, you know, G20 in Manhattan, where they can pull in cops from Jersey and arrest 10,000 people. They can't. They can't even arrest 500 people. It's hilarious how under-equipped the Canadian police forces and security services are. So,
and also because the people weren't destructive, what were they doing? Well, they were singing the Tragically Hip, and they were barbecuing, and they were just partying in toques. Look, that's what we do. Nothing really destructive happened. If I had my way, things might have gone differently, but we're not going to talk about that. but like we were saying, there's certain opportunities that present themselves in a place where you would count them out. Something like Canada, I think, has a lot of very fascinating options that could be born. And when it comes to the crypto topic, this was the big news. I would actually defer to Distributus' point on that. I was listening to him earlier today. I liked his take on what this means for crypto. I don't want to just rehash the exact same thing, but in short, I believe that this really showed people the limitations of crypto. For anyone who was deluded to think that this would just be magic anti-government money, I'm not saying that crypto is bad. I'm fascinated with blockchain technology, but you must rethink how you will utilize this thing, because it turns out that the gayest government in the world can just take your money.
Yeah.
Well, this was a thing about the trucker convoy, the protest, that different things were tried, and the regime gradually worked out a solution, a response to each of these things. And one of them would be crypto. I mean, it was kind of funny to watch, and I didn't take any pleasure in this, but it was ironic to see them using, I think it was GoFundMe. Yes, it was. It was GoFundMe.
Yeah.
And anyone more experienced in rebelling against the mainstream could have said to them, do not use GoFundMe. Do not use PayPal.
Yeah.
Do not even think that that is going to work. But I think, and this is an interesting aspect of it, it was basically a bunch of sort of normies and people had no idea what they were doing. They'd never really rebelled before. They had no experience of how easily the regime, internationally speaking, the regime can just crack down on you, and will.
Sorry, Jesus, were you going to say
something? That's the interesting thing. If you listen recently, because they're in this, like, the committee where they're exposing a lot of what went on there, right? So recently, Tamara Leach was deposed or questioned in regards to this. She was one of the people leading it. I don't know if you remember, she was doing a lot of live streams and things during the event. She was the one originally, she's from Saskatoon, I think, who set up the GoFundMe and set up like kind of the finance side of the movement. She had been involved in a few other local protests to do with the oil industry, like convoys out there in the previous year. And I don't think they ever were more than a few hundred people. And that was her experience. That's all she'd ever done. She hadn't done a GoFundMe before. She'd just done local fundraising. She says, you know, she's like selling cupcakes at the local high school type thing. But that's the interesting thing, is you have somebody like that who is a grassroots community organizer, working through this idea in her head, along with some people from Manitoba and from Alberta, who had said that this affects all of them and they wanted to get together. And then the turning point was when they decided to set up a GoFundMe, which gives you the option of increasing the amount, and the amount of support that flowed in. Suddenly this went from $20,000 to $100,000 to $10 million. And you're in this situation where, like, yeah, these are not the people that you want to have running this. They're the people that you want there for decision making, but they're not the people you want with the checkbooks or making political strategy decisions, because they are just truly genuine, authentic grassroots people. But it is really heartening to know that they got that far. Imagine how far they could get with real organization, right?
That's a good point, Jiz. And so, on that topic, I believe you had said on a previous interview, might have been with Course of Empire, about how they didn't know how to get to the next level of the protest. That's an interesting way to put it. And I'm going to just dive into that a little bit. So there's this book I really like called Coup d'État by Edward Luttwak, who I believe you might count him as a neo-realist. We covered him on our show a while back. This is a very fascinating book. It is a guide on how to overthrow a government, citing real examples, even some from the 20th century. The failed coup in France, I believe, is a very interesting one. He makes a point, and this is a point about grassroots movements and arguably revolutions. And when I say this, I will include fascist and communist revolutions in this, is that in the early days, in the book, he outlines that you almost need to be vague. The only way to unite people is to almost present them a scaffolding or a framework of revolution and have them auto-complete it or fill it in themselves. You want to avoid specifics. That's how you can unite all these disparate people who kind of think they're on the same path or they have the same enemy. But later on, it's when, you know, you start, that's the fucking reign of terror. That's, you know, the night of long knives. That's all that stuff. So there is a point later on where you kind of get in there and get rid of all the undesirables. But for a populist movement, and I'm not trying to advocate this, but I'm saying that any populist movement must by necessity be vague, at least for the start. And once it succeeds, and you saw this with January 6th, it's like, well, we did succeed, what now? And I don't use that as a mark against them, because some people will look at that and fucking what, armchair revolutionize about what they should have done. But I find that's not their job. Just like, kind of, you know, to get into this a bit, why not Kanye West? It's like, well, is Kanye West the strategist we need? It's not his fucking job. That's supposed to be our job. Yeah. He's a rapper. First of all, don't trust any musician. If you see a musician, you throw him in the fucking lake. That's first of all. Second of all, if you're a musician, their job is to get up on stage and say, hey, how about this? And they're supposed to be crazy. They're supposed to be drunk. They're supposed to be borderline retarded. After that is when that's the next step. That's when that's an opportunity presented to people who deal with these sorts of things. So I see a lot of people who accomplished goals. What I didn't see was a follow through plan. And maybe that is our failing. Maybe that's my failing. Maybe that's the failing of a lot of people who didn't think. I find this is a problem in the dissident right broadly. And I try not to critique us as if we are one movement, because we're not. But one thing is, we're not very comfortable with win states. We're not very good when we get what we want. We're not very good of thinking when we act, if we were to succeed, what would a step after that be? We all of us kind of stand there dumbfounded mm-hmm. when it happens. So I think if there's a need for anything, there is sort of the day two plan of what happens when you have that power, so it doesn't just fizzle out. In a nonviolent way, again, just to reiterate, I'm not trying to say bring out the guillotines or anything, but there has to be something. I don't think anyone's really talked about that. And that is a more interesting conversation to me. No, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's a probable reason. Well, there are two that I can think of. One is that we're just natural complainers and critics. But the other is, I think, with the climate of oppression and censorship, we that might well have affected us at a deeper level than we realize, such that we can't even conceive of having power. I mean,
it's a
rather depressing idea, but there we go.
And I think, and again, not everyone, and I hate to be someone who says, here's the problem with the dissident right. I'm not trying to do that. I'll talk broadly in broad strategic terms. I think there's a lot of people in the world, in the corporate world, the business world, whatever, who have a difficult time with very firm, practical goals. Something you can accomplish within 6 months, 3 months, 1 year. A lot of our goals are civilizational in scope. We have a hard time breaking down our problems into these sub problems. You know, what do? We decry that the West has fallen, but that's really like 20 separate problems with not just one group at the top. You know, there's one group at some of the tops, but not all of them. So, and that's why when I look at the distant right, I see a lot of very diverse individuals talking about very different things, and people trying to say, well, which is the one that's doing it? I see it as an ecosystem. I see a lot of correct people. There's certain people that I really admire who really focus just on economics, and they are not wrong. I might think they don't incorporate some other things, but then there's other people who take the spiritual side and they don't take into account any of the stuff at all. And very few people really talk about the implications of technology. And that, what I mean, like artificial intelligence, I think a lot of people subtly think that it won't be an issue, or it might not, like a very, very serious artificial intelligence might not become a reality in the future, you know. So, but there are all these people, they're not supposed to look at everything. We have a lot of sectors. And I think if you kind of incorporate all of them, you can actually get, we have the makings of a very broad movement. It's not one movement in one direction, it's in 100 directions. And that's why it'll work, because I find, let's call them leftists, let's call them liberals too, they lack the nuance, and they lack the insight to really address the problems, which gets them into more trouble than I think we give them credit for. And I think over the past few years, a lot of them, you know, people talk about like infighting. Who gives a shit? Like we can infight. Half of my listenership calls me gay every day. I don't fucking care. It is funny, but you know what I mean? It's like we can banter, we can argue, we can debate. We're not actually enemies. It's supremely gay for so many people to have so many enemies in this scene. It's just fucking arguments. So, but I'm like, that is what happens when people with different worldviews are actually operating in one direction. And there won't be one philosopher king to lead them, because that would make it not work. So when I look at the decentralized nature of this ecosystem, I am way more optimistic than I think a lot of people are. And sorry, that was kind of a ramble. I just wanted to bring that up.
Well, Judas, would you have anything to say about all of that?
Yeah. No, I broadly agree. Yeah, yeah. I always do that after he's read a large part of the book, and it's like, which fucking part do I respond to? But I think there's a, I don't know if I want to call it a crisis, but a problem, which is a problem of framing. And I think you kind of touched on it a little bit, which is that we've been on the bottom for so long that we wake up in the morning and we go out in the world and we see through these kind of sepia lenses that everything is against us and we don't have any power and there's nothing that we can do. And kind of what I was saying earlier about blood being in the water as a result of how visible their weakness is. If a large enough number of us can get in the mindset that it isn't that difficult, we are intelligent, affable, powerful people. We have strengths and we have the ability to do things and to affect change. It would be a lot easier to get a lot more done. And I mean, and applying that mentality of understanding the weakness of your enemy, not even a specific weakness, but just having a general attitude day to day that your enemy is actually not that intelligent. They're struggling. They're clearly afraid of you. We have them. I wouldn't say we have them on the run, but like they're frightened of us, right? So I think for Canada specifically, I have an optimistic outlook for maybe the next 10 years.
We do have them on the ropes. How many people committed suicide because we were let back on Twitter? Oh, it ain't zero.
They are on the ropes, literally. Oh, shit.
There's a non-zero amount of people that kill themselves because they let the fucking Canadians in.
Well, let's get to what was something that you said earlier, just a few minutes ago, that liberals and the left are scared, and that by contrast, the dissident right has a lot of high quality people in it. How far would you take that? Would you say that liberal, and it's maybe disrespectful or incorrect to speak about the left as a singular entity, but would you say, broadly speaking, that it has run out of ideas? because I think it has. I mean, I think that the Great Reset stuff was interesting. That seemed actually quite novel to me. But the mainstream, I think they really don't know what they're doing or where society is going or where it should be going. I think they're very much coasting on the exhaust fumes of, you know, the last 100 years. Dimes, what would you say to that?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, on one hand, on a very surface level, you would notice that they're more interested in suppressing ideas than coming up with their own ideas. But then you would also say that this liberal project is almost anti-idea. I would recommend people to really understand the liberal mind and to make sense of what this is. And I'm not talking about, we had a whole series about the foundations of liberalism that I'm pretty proud of. We talked about Crisis of the European Mind by Paul Hazard. I think it's Hazard. Some people say Hazard, but they suck. And we talked about The Law of Civilization and Decay by Brooks Adams, a bunch of them. Great books. But the modern liberalism, as we see it, I really do think it has a lot more to do with the End of History and The Last Man by Francis Fukuyama, because within that, you will almost see a caustic neutrality. Like they think that we don't need ideas anymore. We have the material means to end suffering. So really at the center, I think, of the liberal project, and you saw this after World War One, too, and I think that was in Return of the Strong Gods by R.R. Reno. Doesn't matter. Point being that really what they want to end is suffering. And if that is your one goal, you will take a lot of really crazy swings to succeed at that. And it's a goal where you believe that you're on the side of the angels. And if you were to ask a liberal who is well-read, a leftist, this is where they're similar, that what they want to do is end human suffering. And this welds very easily onto what we call the longevity project, or the longevity movement, rather. And we talked about this on the show many times. People are probably tired of hearing about it. I don't give a shit. We're going to talk about it now. The longevity movement is hand-in-hand with transhumanism as a real thing, not a conspiracy. They've got websites. They got people in charge of this. The goal is to end death, to cure death. And many of the advocates of this would be your Jeff Bezos, is your Mark Zuckerbergs. They talk about, and again, this is from a very arguably, you know, very pure, meaningful position where they're like, we want to end suffering. Why can't people live forever? Why can't we do that? Why wouldn't that be the only thing we're here for? That's the question the liberal asks. And what's difficult is that to justify everything they will do, because oftentimes when the way we get where we are is because liberals were presented questions that they don't have an answer for. They don't have the ability to explain why child drag shows are bad, for example. So they can't. And so really it's just waiting for that to happen. But the issue is they're saying, well, are you against peace? Are you against, you know, cool things, whatever, like treat, you know, that's probably a weird example, but I think even that's getting pushed back. But the problem is that if they're saying everything we do is to prolong life and make life materially peaceful, which appeals very much to many Marxists, then you are put in the unenviable position of being pro-death. And that's where a lot of us are hitting a wall, where we need to be pro suffering. We need to be pro, we don't need to go into like billions must die territory, but maybe. But then you almost need to be like, make a case for why someone shouldn't live for 200 years. That's difficult to do. We can probably say these things are self-evident, but we are in non-self-evident times. There is a crisis of legitimacy at every single level of society. No one trusts doctors. No one trusts politicians. No one trusts nothing. They don't trust what they see. They don't even trust their own reality. Yeah. We're building another one. So nothing is taken for granted. So I think the project that we are engaged in, many of us are trying to reaffirm the basics, and we might think it goes without saying, but everything has to go with saying now, because everyone is in such a fucking darkness.
It's easy for us to go off and assume that people have like a basic understanding of their own culture and myth and morality and heritage, and all of these little things like the fabric of your life that gives it value. But actually, most people are so atomized that they don't. And so if you have institutions that are taking big swings and you can put a nice big brand and a label on that big swing, they're fine to get behind that. And they don't notice the thousand little things that they've lost. So like you're saying about being pro-suffering or pro-death. We don't necessarily have to tell people that we're pro-suffering or pro-death, but we have to explain where death and suffering fit in as a minor element in this tapestry of life and value and belief, and show it in relation to all of the other things that you are losing. And I'm being very broad here and very vague, obviously, because there's so many things that you could talk about, but this is kind of already what we do on the podcast. Like we take topical events and we break them down using books, using some references, but in layman's terms, we want people to have a basis for understanding their own life and the times that they live in, so that you don't get cowed so easily by big single issues.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say about the thing about death and suffering, and Dimes, when you were saying that, you mentioned billions of people dying. I mean, I want to be clear, because I know that this could be easily misconstrued and used against you and me. So I want to put it in my own terms. I think what we're talking about here is we need to rediscover the value of life, because life has become so easy and so void of struggle and to, in a certain sense, void of pain, that we take it very much for granted. We don't know what is it to struggle? What is it to have a meaningful existence?
Yeah.
That's the problem. And so everything has become sort of slush. And I think this is something I'm very, Dimes, you go.
I was just going to say, something that occurred to me, and I think you raised a very good point there. One thing that I just got reminded of, I know I'm not supposed to talk about this guy, but Lex Fridman, he had a guy, we talked about this on the show, Jews. Remember we were talking about that sort of biologist guy who was talking about those worms and they reproduce by essentially just cloning themselves?
Like planarians?
Yeah, something like that. But the idea is, he said, what makes humans unique is that we have an evolutionary bottleneck, and that is the birth-death process. So the fact that we don't duplicate ourselves perfectly across time, some people might see that as a bug. I think an interesting scientific way to look at it would be as a feature. So if we were to be on the side of life, I like that. Let's not be on the side of death. Let's be on the side of life. But the necessity of life going through that bottleneck so that only the most important stuff remains and before it explodes out again. So that sort of flux going out and in and out and in, that if you were to mount an argument against transhumanism, that might be the way to do it. Not death, but evolutionary bottleneck. And that applies to culture. That applies to religion. That could apply to your genes. Also, I just want to say, I can't read the chat right now. I'm getting messages that some people didn't like that musician comment. So let me just say for the record, there's a lot of things that we say that are, you know, hyperbolic, that we go over the top. We say things that we don't mean for comedic effect. Having said that, I will kill every musician on earth, and I'm going to do it with my own fucking hands.
Thanks, Sam.
All right. So Judas, you wanted to chip in here.
No, that's all right. You know what I was going to say is just, I think the billions must die comment was, you're referring to the Chud meme, right, Dimes? Is that what you threw that in?
Which one?
No, there's a meme floating around that's just a Chud in McDonald's. Billions must fry, billions must cry.
Oh, yeah. It's like a meme. That's what I was saying. Like, people are like, you know, the joke is that you fucking drop your ice cream cone and you say billions must die to yourself,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, right. I see. I'm not familiar with that meme.
Oh, no. Fuck. Every time I see, I walk on the street and I see, you know, a tall woman, I say the West has fallen.
All right. Well, I think the general point that I was getting to earlier is that I think life is too easy nowadays. And I mean, the millennials seem to sum this up, seem to embody this, that they don't really know about struggle. But Dimes, you want to say something?
Oh, I was going to say, I agree. And this comes up a lot. And I've seen some very people I respect, people I like, they will see that. And they'll try and rediscover things from the past. Like, I knew a guy who was getting into farming. He was only going to do it by using the tools that his ancestors going back 10 generations did. So he would even be anti maybe motorized tractor, just doing everything by hand. And I respect that. That's a discipline I can admire. But I am interested in ways of introducing, like you had said, introducing struggle, but it's new struggle. It's not just kind of living like an Amish guy. Now, what do you think about that?
Well, it seems that you want a struggle ideally to be authentic. And so if it's something that you've just chosen, that it's like, well, I've got the same struggle as my great-great-grandfather had. I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, that's clearly a genuine struggle. But on the other hand, it's like you could switch it off at any moment. You could just go back. Yeah, you could just get it's like the rich kid roughing it. At any time, he can just phone up his parents and they can just, you know, send $1,000 into his account.
Yeah. And also, it's I know there's a few guys in my chat who might find this interesting. They'll say this is like a uniquely Anglo thing. I'm not going to weigh in on whether it is or not, but the idea of being in a Anglo country, Canada and America, pretty much, and then still seeking out ways to make life difficult. That's why camping and, you know, rock climbing seem uniquely appealing to only certain types of people. And we can just leave it at that. But I look around and I see only a certain type of person who's into, you know, being a millionaire and then going climbing K2 or something like that. And I find that interesting too. And I think going forward, the question we have to ask in very practical terms is how to find new ways to discipline ourselves, because it is necessary. Otherwise your mind just fucking atrophies, you know?
Mm. Oh, definitely. I mean, I have a huge amount of admiration for people who, you know, there's that the sort of cliche about, I think it was a mountaineer was asked, why did you climb this mountain? And he said, because it's there. I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, but the idea is it was a struggle waiting to be embraced. It was a struggle. It was a challenge waiting to be taken on. The mountain is there. It's waiting. I can look away from it and just have an easy life. But then, well, then what am I doing? What am I? I do personally feel, I mean, I've always been very driven in my own, not mountaineering, not anything outdoorsy, I'm afraid, but I've always been very driven to find challenges and then overcome them, usually, you know, creative challenges. Indeed, every creative project that I've taken on, it's really been a problem to solve. It's like how to do this thing, or whether, you know, whether creatively or intellectually. Because that's essential. I wouldn't want it to be easy. If it were easy, then it's fucking meaningless. This is something that's, you know, just sort of natural to me. I don't really understand men, specifically men, who don't want that challenge. I don't really understand them.
It's Faustian.
I was about to say, you're going to have Dr. Ricardo Duchesne on later on. That's like his big thing when I talk to him. He's a really great Canadian writer, and his expertise is kind of in that area. To that point, my fear is that this is kind of more of like an Edward Dutton angle, but it's like I do think that the evolutionary pressures are going to maybe squeeze that out of us. My fear is that across the generations, we will lose that ability to do things that are uncomfortable. Because almost the dark side of what you're talking about, you know, on one hand, they're seeking out difficult things. On the other hand, and I work in marketing, so I deal with this all the time, is the gamification of the mundane. And my fear is that, and this ties into TikTok, this ties into a lot of things, but the gamification of the mundane, that you cannot do anything unless it is delightful, that poses a threat to, I think, the success of generations. I don't think you're really going to see it that. You might see it a bit with Gen Z, but if things don't change, you might just, you know, socialize that out of people in a very real biological way. That's my concern.
What do you mean by the gamification of the mundane?
Oh, so, you know, if you want to like fill out a form in marketing, we talk about trying to like bring people through the funnel of taking steps to do something. If you make it fun, you know, let's talk about TikTok. You know, I'm not going to split the atom on this, but like TikTok is designed by everyone's favorite Asians to create something that people just get dopamine hits in a very, very regulated way of endless scrolling in a way that is not present in other social media platforms. So there are ways to code in sort of dopamine hits and making things fun to the point, and kind of the cell phone is that, like, you just don't want, you don't know how to just sit alone. You don't know how to stand and wait. That's going to be a very old man yells at cloud thing to say, but multiply that by 100 other things. And I've talked about this because I got a son on the way. My wife is pregnant. And so we talk about this stuff. We talk about how I wasn't raised with a screen like that. Cause we're, you know, we're old, we're in our mid 30s. And a generation that doesn't know how to sit bored in a car, that's a foundational experience of being like a young person, is going on a road trip and just like staring at the fucking window and you're forced to develop something in your mind to deal with that. And so, you know, there's other things in society that do the similar thing. And I think, again, probably Edward Dunn would be the one to talk about this, about, you know, evolutionary pressures. But, you know, I mean, on our scene, we always talk about like ADD and stuff. It's hard to tell if that's like new or if it's always kind of been there. But I do think there is sort of like mental engineering going on, where maybe in two generations, people don't, they will have been bred out of like seeking out difficulty. Now, that's the worst case scenario. But what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, if I had kids, I would just keep them away from television, from the internet until, I don't know. An age is difficult to pin down. But definitely I would want them to, like, their childhoods to just be free of this poison.
Yeah.
Because I do think it's poison. Even for adults, it's poison. God knows what effect it must have on kids. We all know this. It's obvious.
Something that comes into view for me pretty often, because I have two young daughters, and like I do let them sit in front of the TV fairly often because I work. My wife doesn't work, but she's a homemaker and we don't have a lot of money. So we're in a situation where you have to. And I think for a lot of young parents, especially young parents that work, that don't have a lot of money, if you don't have childcare, like the Canadian childcare situation is atrocious, then you do have to choose between principles about how you raise your kids and then just making sure that you have healthy meals or that you have some repairs done around the house or something like that, which is what we sometimes have to do. Now, definitely my kids take in less of that than other kids. But what comes into view for me then is, what are the differences between my life and the life of my ancestors, even one or two generations back, that they were able to do this and I'm not? Like, how is it that on a single income, and obviously this is a little bit used, it's almost a trope now, but how is it that on my single income, and my wife working all day long, we still can't actually achieve the same type of life that even my grandparents' generation had? And you start looking at the costs of things, and you start looking at the type of access that you have, like media and social media and television, and the type of access you don't have. Like, why can't I buy beef tallow at the grocery store? Why can't I get tools at a reasonable price? Well, there's certain tools that I can't even get anymore. Like, if I wanted to, there's certain types of repairs if I wanted to do to my house, I'm not even legally allowed to do it. I have to call a licensed electrician and pay him $4,000 that I don't have. So,
you know, funny.
Part of it is the society that has been built around us. Until you get down to the foundational level and you start trying to achieve these things, the cage that you're in becomes really visible.
Sorry to interrupt you. This reminded me of a story that's so funny and tragic. One of my clients I had years and years and years ago, small client, and he was just sort of like a retired construction guy, you know, probably just a high school diploma, if that. And he was retired. His wife was retired. They're kind of, you know, older age, and he wanted to kind of start his own business just to make some extra money. And he wanted to start a power washing business. So you just get a power washer and you go clean people's houses, their driveways, whatever it is. And the funny thing is, to just do that in Ontario, where we live, like, you needed 6 certifications. So you needed a special type of insurance to climb a ladder. You needed a special type of insurance to have this type of pressure washer and to operate it. Like, this is just a guy who wanted to buy a thing and do a thing. Yeah. And he just can't do that. They won't let him. They'll put him in jail if he fucking tries. And he did some of it, but like some of it, he's like, all these things cost money also to get. And I was just a bricklayer my whole fucking life.
So if that type of guy stays in his lane and takes the type of job that society has set up for him and uses the types of institutions that are set up for him, he's never going to notice this, especially if he's somebody who has a decent income, right? And I don't want to say all those people are golems, but they're fucking golems, because they hold back They push back on the rest of us who notice these changes and notice the essentially the peasant or serf life that that we've been left in. And this is kind of a tangent from what we were talking about with about a child rearing, but yeah, it's wild at where we've gotten to.
We're a tangent friendly show, so that's okay.
Yeah, we're very tangential.
I cannot even remember what the question was.
I should emphasize, you know, I'm not a parent, I don't have kids, and I'm not trying to preach to anyone who is a parent. I wouldn't dream of doing that. My comment was that, you know, I imagine I would want, you know, in theory, I would want to guard my kids against the TV and whatever modern manifestations it's in. Even though I have a lot of affection for TV off the past, but today it just seems dreadful.
Yeah. So because we're morons, we've got like three different streaming platforms. You know, once you get a wife, they like things like that. They like having a bunch of subscriptions to all sorts of things, and you browse and you go to bed angry. But, you know, you do scroll around and see, you know, like, what are kids watching these days? And it's like, oh, the 5-year-olds are also watching Euphoria. Well, that can't be right. But as a parent, and I'm, you know, obviously Judas over here has got two daughters who are like, what, 2 and 1 now?
Yeah, 3 and 1.
So you've got a bit more of an advanced read on the situation. But the problem is, you know, I would be one of those guys who's like, I'm not going to let my kid have a phone. But, you know, where the rubber meets the road, you don't want your kid to be weird for not having a phone. Because then, you know, I decided with my wife that we're going to raise our son a psycho. But, you know, if we're going to raise him as a loser, that's not going to work either. So you'll get these like weird extra pressures from the outside where you'll be outcast if they don't. And you get this in your real life. If you don't have a social media presence, you might as well be Albanian. Yeah. The worst type of thing to be.
Well, you know, I've got a social media presence. I don't know if it would do me much credit in the normie world. But I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, this is a big matter, actually. It comes up quite a lot in our sphere. I mean, how do you raise kids? Because no one wants their own kids to be weirdos. So how do you avoid? I mean, I've no idea.
This is the question, yeah.
It's a huge thing.
And also, we're talking about now, and in 10 years, what will it be? Because the acceleration of all this stuff is getting, you know, we haven't really mastered VR yet, but that's going to be a whole kettle of fish. Sorry, I think I cut you off there, Judas.
No, it's all right.
Well, I mean, the other aspect is what you touched on is that this guy who's basically a handyman, he just wants to do a simple job, but the bureaucracy makes it ridiculously complicated. This kind of thing is, it just seems such a, like it must be throttling ordinary society, ordinary people every single day. It's the kind of thing that makes me wish, I just want it all to fall apart. I just want it all to crumble.
Yeah.
Because this is so unhealthy.
Yeah.
And it also seems, sorry.
No, you go.
I was just going to say, it almost seems unfair that my emotional feeling about it very often is this is so complicated and the damage to me and to my people and to my family is so spans such a long space of time and has hurt so many people. And then you start thinking about how do you disentangle this? How do you resolve this? This is like a Jenga tower of different issues, each one relating to the next that all have to be resolved. Who do I owe so badly that I must disentangle this in a safe way, in a way that doesn't hurt anybody else? Like, am I really going to take the high ground and solve all of this for their sake? If I want to solve it for my sake, like you said, Woz, you just kind of just want it to all fall apart. Because a lot of the stuff that I want personally, I could get easily in absence of the system. It's not that I need to rebuild a better system in its place. It's this system is a cage. It's purpose built to hurt us, all of us. So just getting rid of it would be a great step one. Obviously, that's not a thing that's possible. But like the sentiment, it's not an unreasonable sentiment. It's not a sentiment. It's not a nihilistic thing to say, oh, I just want to destroy it all. But yeah, well, I mean, it's a cage. Of course, you want to get rid of it.
Yes. Yeah, that's something I was talking to Ayatollah about on our unreleased episode because my internet wasn't very good. But, you know, we were talking about how much awareness factors into outreach to these people. So for, let's use this guy as an example. You know, he will, you know, be upset that he can't do what he wants, but he won't be angry because of it. And what you want to do is to elevate that, you know, annoyance to anger, and then eventually to elevate that anger to action. But that's really, like you had said earlier, Judas, that's kind of what's standing in the way. So it's how to effectively animate people to realize, like you just said, that no, this thing is designed to keep you in a cage. It's not just, you know, a lot of the Canadians that I know and a lot of the kind of boomer liberals will kind of throw their hands in the air like, oh, that's how it is. It's just the system sucks. Like if you've dealt with Canadian healthcare for 5 minutes, you'll say, yeah, I guess it sucks. What are you going to do? You'd say, well, yeah, what are you going to do? Because it can't be nothing. Otherwise, and it's the healthcare example is a very good one because that's life and death. That is literally maybe your wife has been waiting for 5 months for a surgery and now she might die because you have not, you know, you've been making excuses for this engine that is designed to keep you quiet and to keep you at just a level of annoyance, but like you're out of the way, you know, you're a problem to them. So the system sees you as a problem. And then what are you going to do about that?
This is where I think there is a sharp distinction between normies and people like us. And I know some people don't like the term normies, but again, I'm using it for the sake of brevity. I think that the average person is geared to simply accept the situation that they find themselves in, even if it's with a weary shake of the head or a sigh. That's what they're going to do. They're going to rationalize it so that they don't have to rebel, because they desperately don't want to rebel. And what I mean by that is they don't want to put their head above the parapet. They don't want to be the odd one out. They don't want to be seen to be pushing themselves up above other people. The accusation is always just a few syllables away. Well, who are you to say how things should be? Who are you to? Who made you an expert? Where is your qualification to say that, you know, 10-year-old boys shouldn't be dancing semi-naked in front of gay men? How do you know that? When this expert says that they should be doing that, or whatever it is, you know. But this could go for any facet of life. I think the normie is geared to just accept it, even if it pisses him off. And that's probably the way human beings are evolved to be. That probably that has to be that way, because otherwise society would just be, well, people like us constantly arguing.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunities for people on our side to create positivistic arguments. So like you had just said, when someone says, who are you to say, I would push back, why? Explain to me why this is good. In your own words, explain to me why this is a good thing to do. And I promise you they won't be able to do it. So that's kind of the thread you start to pull on. Demand them, because we've got a pretty good set of positivistic stances to take. Many people on the theological side, the political history side, all kinds of different, you know, angles to take. But like, lean on the fact that these people don't know what the fuck they're doing. They're just responding to this sort of ill-informed social proof. And as long as you don't sound like a schizo when you do it, most of the, you know. Just to say this, I know there's been a lot of goings on back and forth about this idea of sensible centrism, and I don't want to speak to that. You can speak to an academic agent later about that. And while there's some things I might not agree with, I do like the core tenet, which is that the things we say and the things we think are not as extreme as they would have us believe. We're actually not extreme. You're not crazy. You're not a schizo. These are reasonable things to believe, and they have the benefit of being proven by time. That should be enough. And I think as long as people kind of remember that, you know, they are scared of us, and you're not crazy. We can joke. We can say, we call each other schizos all the time. You're not fucking crazy. So, you know, just act like you deserve to be here, because they're the fucked up weird ones. And your average liberal doesn't even have the language to explain why they believe what they believe. I do this every time I meet my father-in-law, every time I meet my parents, every time I meet my family members. Just play this game and sharpen your tools like that. You can probably explain as big of an idea as you have. You can probably explain it to your stupid fucking uncle and then it will enlighten him. Most of them don't have this like true anger against stuff. That's my experience anyway. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it differs. This is something where I think it, like, different countries do have different cultures and deal with this kind of thing differently. Because in Britain, I think there's a lot of... this goes back to the trucker protest, actually. I don't think the trucker protest would happen in Britain. But it did happen in Canada. And I think it's partly because of this difference in the culture. I think in Britain, there is far more of a sort of... like. Expectations, like in the working class, and I was talking about this with Dangerfield. In the working class, it's well, who are you? Who do you think you are to decree that? You're getting above your station. In the middle class, it's well, I've got fashionable ideas. I'm not going to say something unfashionable, for God's sake. So there's a sort of drive towards conformity either way. Whereas I think that doesn't apply in Canada. At least it seems to apply much less.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. You are, and like, I'm not saying it'd be easy either, because, you know, a lot of, and even a lot of the revolutionaries that we see, you know, I'm always think of, when I think of the UK, I think of Philosophy Tube, you know, that trans contemporary, just like waging a revolution that's like, we're against the most pro-trans, the NHS, the most pro-trans fucking health agency in the world, but you're still waging your little revolution. So like there's permitted revolutions, I suppose, is what I'm saying. Like you can stand on the stage and you're, with your huge shoulders and weird dress and say, we're going to bring them down as they are already kneeling before you. So, you know, I guess that is true, but I still do believe that even on some of the more extreme issues, there are ways, and this is what we do in marketing all the time. Like you wouldn't do it in one debate. You wouldn't do it in one confrontation, but I do believe there are ways to seed these ideas with if any person. If you have 4 months, you can bring them around on essentially anything. You know, I can make the most anti-Semitic Jew in the world if you give me 4 months. It's all I need, baby.
He's very convincing. Wow.
You see, my experience is you'll say something and you've got the right argument and the person can't refute it. But what they'll do then is say, well, but it must be getting handled. Like for example, something like Rotherham. So you've got 1,500 girls in one town sexually assaulted or raped by Pakistani Muslims, mostly. And I remember talking to a normie guy about this, and his response was, well, look, we don't need to discuss this because the government must have it under control.
Yeah, it's total faith in the system. And I think you're going to see that break a lot slower with more established civilizations like Britain. There's so much history. There's so much, you know, there's this fascinating book, The Construction of Nationhood by Adrian Hastings, which we also covered. I bet a lot of people have read that, but it proposed that the very model itself of nationhood was, in the modern sense, pioneered by Britain, which inspired other of its neighbors to nationalize, but it was really the first. So there's this sense of permanence, I think, in the UK. I'm not saying that as a criticism. I say it as admiration, especially since Canada, Australia, New Zealand are essentially appendages of that empire. But I think you will get a lot of pushback, like total faith in the system, because they are afraid, because if they admit that it's not, that means everything unravels. So sometimes I look at that person and I say, are you really steadfast in your beliefs or are you afraid? And you kind of see that with COVID. And I've got nothing but borderline arrestable things to say regarding individuals and the whole COVID thing. Not going to say them here, but I've even edited some out of the show. But the idea is that I think a lot of people, when I calm down, I have a tea, I look at a lot of the people with COVID, I'm like, you're actually really scared. You're scared to really admit what happened. So I think fear is a different emotion I can work with than vigor. What do you think about that, Judas, or anyone?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's absolutely, I don't have much to say on it other than that's been my experience that, it's vigor and passion are something that drive people, but it's not a way for you to convince somebody and control them. Fear is the much better way to quote unquote convince. But I mean, another way to say convince is to manipulate or to cajole. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, COVID was a fantastic example of this. And I think that climate change is, they're trying to make that into a second, even better example of it. This is why they start early with the kids and get them terrified about climate change and have them believing that we're all going to, you know, fry in the heat of the sun. I mean, that's been going on for, I don't know, more than a decade at this point. Because I remember people talking about it in 2012, 2011. Fear is how they got people doing things like wearing masks and social distancing, getting the vaccine. A lot of, I mean, it's easy for us to forget this, or at least it's easy for me to forget this, because I'm generally not surrounded by normies in my day-to-day life. But people were fucking terrified. I mean, you know, for me, it was a sort of spectacle. It was a sort of sociological nonsense that was going on, and something that I could analyze, but, you know, sort of academic thing. But I think for most people, the experience of COVID was really the experience of being really frightened for 2 years, enough that a lot of people actually just literally stayed indoors for most of that time, which is just incredible to me. I mean, even I, you know, and I'm a famous shut-in, even I didn't stay indoors all the time during that. You know, I was going out just as normal.
Me too.
The people were, I think a lot of people were genuinely terrified. And while we can retrospectively bloviate about the different injustices, you know, the vaccine and whatever, and the economic damage of lockdown and all that, it's easy to forget the psychological toll that was inflicted on ordinary people. They were in fear. And of course, you've got to think, well, this is the government. So, okay, that's like exhibit number one of why our governments, our way of life needs to be changed drastically. Because if we have governments who are happy to have us living in fear, well, then they're not very good. I mean, it's just so obvious. You can't hardly even need to say it.
Yeah. And that's kind of what drove a wedge between a lot of people in this thing of ours. Still not from Thomas 777, yoink, buddy. But the wedge was the current, one of the wedges that exists now is like when you talk about like the elites, when we talk about the power structures, it's are we against these elites or are we against elites as such? That's sort of what's being litigated right now on the right. So there's some people who come out of this being anti-statist or perhaps some kind of, you know, multipolarity type person. There's a lot of different versions of it. So, because I think those are the conversations we need to have, because, you know, one question we could ask ourselves is what would happen if the, let's say, American government came out and said, we were wrong about COVID. In fact, we're responsible for COVID. We fucked up everything. Anthony Fauci, he was jerking off the entire time watching this. He thought it was funny. We told him to stop and he wouldn't. What if they came out and said that? Like, what would happen? And again, when I say this, I bring this on myself. I don't try and put this on anyone else to do these actions. I say like, okay, that is where people like us would have to step in. It's like, if we get everything we want, if we were vindicated tomorrow, what would we do? Because we are routinely vindicated in real life. We are routinely proven right about things and nothing ever happens because we don't have a next step. We don't really know what to do with momentum and energy. We got lots of ideas about how to use momentum, but, you know, there's this funny, not funny, but interesting concept by Nassim Taleb, who, you know, I got my issues with him, but in his book, The Black Swan, he talks about what's called the Black Swan event. And a Black Swan event is this event that was completely unpredictable and forces you to rethink how you understand the world in its wake. So these are things that come out of nowhere and kind of change the paradigm. So that could be a theory, that could be the internet, that could be, you know, maybe even World War One. A lot of people, the things that people aren't really good at predicting. Now, what he had said near the end of that book, The Black Swan, I found it was very interesting because he says, now, what we love to do as humans is predict the future. The problem is that what happens is we get very married to our what we think is the most likely to happen, and we ignore all these other things that could happen. So, you know, one example would be our love of collapse scenarios. So throw a rock, you know, hit five guys with five different stories about how the West will eventually fall. But that kind of blinds them to other factors that might impact what's things that are more likely to happen, because they're convinced that they're going to be living in The Road by Cormac McCarthy. So, you know what I mean? So there's this idea that you can't be kind of blinded to this stuff. You can't, you know, you can't kind of get locked into your own worldview about this stuff. Anyway, I was kind of rambling there. I don't know if that answered the question at all.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. It's like, I can't, I just kind of remember how you got into that. You're telling the Black Swan.
Neither can I. I got in the weeds. I'm looking for a fucking life jacket, and you're leaving me out in the fucking suck.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I know you gotta keep a long yellow nylon rope around Dimes to keep him when he goes off on a tangent into the swamp.
He used to give me a helmet too. I've just upgraded to rope.
Well, I mean, the COVID, I just see it as a thing. It's a black swan event. Well, yes, actually, I wouldn't have predicted that. I mean, it's not something that. See, I used to think that the whole thing about authoritarianism, people would drop allusions to 1984, like 10 years ago, and I used to think they're not going to do that. They can't do that. They're incompetent. They don't have the ability to enact to create a police state. But then they did, and Canada perhaps more than anywhere else, actually, because, you know, at least in Britain there was still a semblance of liberty, even with the restrictions. But in Canada and Australia, it seemed to be almost absolute.
Yeah,
and so you realize, okay, well, 1984 is a big cliche, and you know, 2 + 2 = 5, and all. Yeah, it's a big cliche. But that doesn't stop it from actually happening in real life.
Yeah. What's interesting is Australia, I think, is a parallel nation to Canada. If you kind of look at their views on guns and their view on the managerial state. Sorry, I think I just wanted to say that, but I think I cut you off there. Were you going to say something, or did I just cut you off?
No.
Okay. I'll keep going then. So what's interesting about Canada, I think it's more susceptible to this stuff, Australia as well, then America, and then Britain, because on our show we covered Canadian law in a couple episodes there. We looked at the Canadian Constitution, and what we found is that the way our rights are written is very open to this sort of stuff. So when you look at, first of all, the Canadian Constitution, as we call it, is very, very long, which is kind of a bad thing. I think I was reading a Joseph de Maistre recently, his the Imperium Press release on de Maistre. And he was talking about how any rights that begin with a pen or begin with legislation are never rights. So it doesn't come from the people, it doesn't come from the folk or anything like that. He has this in his first essay in the book. But the point being that Canada as a nation wasn't really, the state wasn't grown from the people like it was in the UK. So it's not organic in a state. But it still uses language like reasonable. You see the word reasonable a lot. Like, we allow people to have guns within reason. It has to be reasonable. And that's what kind of brings us to where we are with guns now. We allow freedom of speech as long as it's reasonable. Nowhere is reasonable defined. It is in every instance left up to the judge. There's a lot of leeway given with judges here. And so another thing that they talk about in the Canadian legislation is they talk about the spirit of the law, the spirit of Canada. And I think Canada lacks that spirit, unlike the UK. And so you know, ask any fucking boomer, has the spirit of Canada changed over your life? Have you seen unprecedented things? So really, our legal structure is so open to interpretation. That is how you get things like medical assistance in dying. That is how you get, I got one for you. Here's an example of Canadian law that we looked into pretty extensively. So Canada defines a fetus. We're talking about abortion here, people. Canada defines a fetus as a life, but not a person. So within America, the debate is whether or not it is a person, whether or not it's a human life or just a fetus or a blastocyst or something. No, we admit from conception, it's essentially human life, but it is not legally a person. So for that reason, in many parts of Canada, you can legally kill a baby like 5 minutes before it's crowning. Now, the pushback on that would be, well, no one would do that. That's not reasonable. That's not in the spirit of blah, 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 blah. But there's no firm legal protection on any of this stuff. And with medical assistance and dying, you see how this runaway train could end up you with. I need an apartment. And the government says, have you considered killing yourself?
Well, I've been seeing memes recently like that, you know, like, I can't open this jar of pickles. Have you considered suicide?
Yeah. And it's not just one. It's a few. And these are the few that we know of. These are the few of the people that had the wherewithal to say, I don't think so. Maybe a few didn't. And then I don't see really any steps taken to go back on that. The point being that this sort of, let's call it oppression, is you find a very unique version of that in Canada, because the entire legal structure it's a fertile soil for things like that.
Yeah, Judas, do you want to chime in on that?
I did not have an original thought.
I'm sorry. But
I like that because honestly, he's getting a bit too popular there. I'm looking at the chat. I can't see our chat. Everyone's up. Like, Jews is on fire. I'm we're loving what we're co-host. Hearing.
Yeah.
I like that and thank you.
Yeah. If I get any hotter, I'm going to put Dimes here in maximum danger. It's going to be a max danger situation for
him. Oh, max. Nice.
I would work that in contextually.
So. Also, something came across my desk from my chat, something that made me scowl. Woes, I'm hearing that you do not like Radiohead.
Oh, no.
let's hash this out.
No.
Because
first of all,
that's wrong, but.
I don't want to get into that. It's a different topic. I only know the OK Computer album, and it's just not my kind of thing. I'm sorry. Hold on a second. Let me see what's there were some super chats, so I'll put them to you just now. Someone says, why did you wear the mask? Because it was there. I think that's conflating two topics there. Games like The Whispered World, which are free on Linux, are way better for kids. Build logic, patience, convey stories, etc. You're welcome.
What's that called?
Linux. The Whispered World. The Whispered World. I often talk about Lemmings from back in the day.
Yeah.
Because I had it in the Game Gear. And back Sega Game Gear, well, and it was just terrific. You know,
it's worth saying that, like, broadly speaking, the media itself is not evil. Like, the nature of an interactive media like video games or like a one-way digital media like television isn't itself evil or damaging. It's just the content of that media, because it's controlled by our enemies fundamentally. But that is to say, there are franchises There's specific pieces of these media that are worth giving to kids. There's all kinds of stuff. Like, we go and we censor, like, we dig through television and YouTube. There's actually a lot of good stuff on YouTube right now for toddlers that's kind of in our lane. Like, it's made specifically for people like us who want our kids to watch this. So, like, YouTube is fantastic for that. And I think games is kind of in the same space, where there's a huge indie market for games. So if you want to find games that are politically in a certain genre, you might not find many of them, but it's not like they're completely blocked out of the system like they would be if it was a television show or a film. Like, there's very few TV shows or films.
Yeah.
But yeah, YouTube and video games, there's still, you can find stuff. If you do want to put your kid in front of a screen, you can actually find stuff that isn't going to rot their brain. So,
and there's a lot of good stuff coming out of our scene too. I know there's people who are working on games. There's quite a few children's books out there that seem good. I mean, Jesus Christ, I went shopping for books. There's so much trans children's books.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's just way more than you'd think. Incredible.
I got this book for my daughter. I forget what it's called, but it's like a hard picture book for like 2 or 3 year olds. But just explaining the concept of authority. But it's like essentially an pro family, anti state book. Very, very simply explaining where authority and legitimacy comes from, which is so awesome. I loved it. I bought it immediately when I saw it. Like sometimes you do find stuff like that. That was just in a normal bookstore. I don't even remember where I saw that. But like if you look around, the stuff exists.
Because I keep going into some of these used bookstores. The only bookstores, because I buy a lot of books because I need to read like the hardcovers. But I'll go, and the only thing left is like leftist bookstores. So I'll go in and I'll see comic books about explaining Marx or explain stuff for kids, and I'm like, well, we need one for Ted Kaczynski, we need one for Evola. there's a lot of guys who could use some children's books and comics.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on that. that's just a bit too controversial for me. But yeah, I know what you mean. I do find it shocking. I mean, this stuff about trans, it's amazing how much they're pushing this on kids specifically.
Yeah,
I mean, no one's really, come to think of it now, you know, no one's really talking about trans adults. You know, it's almost entirely oriented towards children.
That's a really interesting point.
I think it's we are within our lifetimes, this is just my prediction. I'm not putting any money on it, but I do think that within the next few years, you are going to see a huge pushback on the trans stuff, because there's a lot of people who obsess about that stuff. I think it's untenable. I think it is the lowest hanging fruit on like wins to get, because, you know, even the people who are like on the left, anarchists, are seeing them as a problem from what I've seen. If you go into leftist spheres, and a lot of people don't, but you can get access to these you know, little struggle sessions they're doing about the trans issue. It's like trans got no friends. So I'm like, you know, I think that will die out. I'm looking past that to what the next thing is and how no one will learn anything from it. But the trans issue is the biggest and loudest issue, but I think there's a pretty short fuse on that, in my opinion. It's just too fucking much. It's too weird. No one likes it. Everyone's bothered by it. It's too gross. And like you had said, people are noticing that it's all about kids, and there's no way for them to justify this. It almost doesn't even require pointing out at this point, but you know, whatever.
You know, because we're looking for property right now, and we're already in the sticks, and we're trying to get even farther away from the lakes, farther away from the cities. And we're looking at, one of the things we're looking for is like the school districts. Like, is it even worth going to any of these public schools? And there's like these buttfuck school boards with like, they probably have like one elementary school or like a mixed middle school, population 2000, and right on the front page of the school board website is trans shit. Like, you people have never seen a trans person. It's fucking logging country. It's a nickel mine. Like, what? Where is this fucking coming from? I swear it's the province.
The only trans they've ever seen is a Trans Am.
They've seen a Trans Am, Canadian Railway or something, right? Like, how on earth is this coming down? It's got to be the province, because there's no way that a bunch of fucking loggers and military people, maybe military, but loggers and their families are so into trans that they petitioned the school board trustee to make this part of the fucking curriculum. So yeah, it's super, super top down, but they're overplaying their hand. Because we're saying earlier, if you give people the opportunity or you allow them to change their frame where they can say, you know what, this isn't acceptable. I am going to put my head above the parapet. I am going to say something. Then you actually have a huge base of support. Like, nobody actually supports this shit. It's kind of the Canadian nature to just roll with it because it isn't immediately affecting me and I have my own problems to deal with. So.
Well, Soaker City says, a black swan event is fundamental to our success. It creates a larger shift in the Overton window than is possible otherwise. It's needed, not optional. Mm. Well, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what black what that could be though. I mean, that's the trouble there. But I do agree that interruptions to the norm are, you know, obviously useful.
That's the fun with the Black Swan event, is it's a wild card that nobody, and it wouldn't be a Black Swan event if you could predict it, right? So if we're the underdog, we can't, like, they can have this grand strategy. We can't really do that because we don't have all of the resources. We're always playing defense. But if we prepare ourselves to be more agile and adaptable to any arbitrarily disastrous Black Swan event, and we can be the ones to capitalize on it when it does come around. I don't know specifically how to do that, but I kind of agree that when you're in the position that we're in, unless, look, if we're steadily winning all these uphill battles, then fine. But if we feel like we're not, then when you see a Black Swan event, like if there was a crypto collapse that had a massive economic change, or a collapse in the property market, or an assassination, or some crazy thing happened that massively shifted things, then we need to be ready as a sphere to capitalize on that as quickly as possible, because that's the only opportunities that we get, right, to get our foot in the door.
Yeah. And also, I'm only 70% sure about this point, so no one's allowed to get mad at me, but it occurs to me that perhaps real Black Swan events are rarely political in nature, because maybe one could make the case that even the French Revolution was not truly unpredictable if you're on the ground. And I would need to review the literature on that. But it seemed like it was a pretty rigid sequence of events that led to that. And you might see more Black Swan events in the realms of the environment or technology, maybe even economics. It would be in these other areas that we typically don't have our eyes on. There's a lot of people in our scene who are effectively anti-science and don't really give a shit about that. But the point would be, well, that stuff's going to impact your life severely. And we don't need to talk about like AI and stuff like that, but there's a wide spectrum of places where Black Swan events could happen that, you know, like you just said, we would never see them coming. But there are ways to plan for it. Like I had Z-Man yell at me one time, if you can believe it, because he deals with this. I think that's his job, because he was like, no, we can predict these. He kind of went off on, there's ways to do it if you are in, if your career is in like risk management, if your career is in statistics, you can, you know, economists do this all the time. But, you know, to what degree it's to be seen. But, you know, anyway.
All right. Then M says, many listeners have taken umbrage with the idea that Radiohead does not suck, when in fact they do suck.
That's not true. Well, that's wrong, that's first.
Just a listener opinion. I'm sure he's probably just having you on. I'm sure he's a huge fan of Radiohead secretly.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I don't know how he could be a listener because he can't hear.
Okay. Got and him. Then Darby finally says, we had our own unique history and culture, but it was destroyed by Pierre Trudeau, Justin's dad. Perhaps Judas or Dimes could touch on this. Well, he's saying that Pierre Trudeau is Justin Trudeau's dad. What do you say to that?
Fidel Castro didn't have that much of an effect on Canada, did he?
No. Also, technically, he is correct. Like, any, this is why I say you can't blame Trudeau, and just like you can't blame the modern conservatives. The roots of this go back a long, long, long way. And there's a couple of books. If people are interested in this sort of thing, there is this book, "Lament for a Nation," by, I believe it's George Grant. I usually say George Scott, and I try not to, because that's an actor. "Lament for a Nation" is it talks about like essentially how nationalism in Canada is impossible, and he makes a case for why. But you know, to that point, like the roots of the problem go back way, way, way further than people think. So it does go back to Pierre Trudeau. And what's interesting in Canada is that Pierre Trudeau, when I was taught about Pierre Trudeau in school, this would have been, you know, he was in the 60s, I believe. He's talked about like this cool hero. He's talked about almost in the tone of an Obama, in the sense that no one really knows why he's great, but everyone just says he is. Everyone just says he's like a rock star, but never really goes into why. But yeah, they would, if you had to say like, who's Canada's top guy, they'd probably tell you Pierre Trudeau. And he was the start of like a lot of the problems we have now. And Justin Trudeau, by comparison, he's funny because he's just so ineffective. Like, he is that proof that, you know, even in elite theory, like, the, a lot of these elites aren't even smart. He is, but I am in awe as he is sort of like the perfect chimera of this experiment, where he, here's a guy, he's so dumb, but he's, he can also do so much racist stuff and get away with it that I admire it. Like, here's a guy, get this. This is something we could never pull off now. That's why you got to admire liberals. He is dressed in blackface on at least two occasions that he was caught for in his past. And when asked about how many times he was in blackface, he couldn't answer you. So it is between two and infinity times that he's been in blackface. Somewhere there. And then you say that, and then it, and then he's like dressing up as an Indian guy, weirdly. And then I see the big news drop will happen. Then they'll go on the street, stick a fucking mic in some black guy's face. He's like, what do you think about that? He's like, well, that's okay. I don't mind. And so I threw my hands up like, I've seen it all. This guy, he's the Teflon man. He walks between the raindrops of racism. So it's just, but how you get to that is with Pierre Trudeau, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, and that's kind of what I was saying earlier too, that there's this weird political apathy in Canada. Like the fact that, like you said, you can walk up to a black guy and explain how many times, possibly infinite times, Trudeau has been in blackface and they don't seem to care. It's like being in Union Station with a bunch of tourists and trying to get somebody interested in a memo that the management's just sent out.
Just for the folks at home, tell them what a Union Station is.
Well, I mean, every city has a Union Station, so I guess I could say that, but it's the biggest station in Toronto. It's a big, stupid old train station that a bunch of tourists walk through every day. My point is, you have a bunch of tourists, people that don't belong there, people that are not invested. They're just passing through. They're just benefiting from being there for a short period of time. That's the analogy here, right? And you give them a memo that came down from the management to the station and try to get them excited, get them energized about it. Yes or no? What do you think? Please sign this form. Get on the survey. They don't fucking care. They're not interested. They already got theirs, right? So, I mean, black guys, what, like you're saying about like Canada having no future as a nation. Like, yeah, we certainly. Well, what am I going to say? Canada, what do they always say? Canada's a nation of immigrants. That's what they say, right? So in places that have a high degree of immigration, and those immigrants are non-white, then how can you expect recent non-white immigrants to give a damn about what's going on in Canadian politics? And then that bleeds into actual, not, you know, old stock Canadians or whatever we want to call them. You get this apathy where unless it's something that's part of one of these big institutional pushes like the trans agenda or like the gun agenda or something, everything else is doesn't matter at all. Nobody is interested in politics at all. It's their job and Netflix and
well, that's whatever. A good point, because not to go too much into this because we're trying to cast a wide net, but you will notice that in a Canada that has a lot of Chinese people, a lot of Indian people, I didn't see none of them in the truckers' protest. It is not on their radar. In fact, I saw many news reports where they're interviewing like Indian truck drivers, and there's a lot of them purposefully not participating. Like it's just they will not engage like that. And
that
whatever
wasn't,
I'll continue. No, you continue.
I was going to say that wasn't covered a lot. We brought it up when it was happening. I hadn't heard a lot of other people talk about that, but and they did. It's funny because Trudeau called the truckers racist, right? But whether they were racist or not is one thing. But what they were is they were largely white, and the people that were complaining about it. This is just an observation, but the truckers that CBC and CTV and the state media found who were complaining about it, saying that trucker protest was destroying their life. Not the shutdowns, not the COVID policies, but the protest was destroying their livelihood. Somehow those guys were all Indian. And I mean, maybe there are a lot of Indian truckers, but I mean, the Indians, do they drive a lot of trucks? I don't know. I know some truckers. I don't know any Indian truckers. So that was weird. Where did you find all these Indian truckers? And then what are you trying to tell us? You know, I'm not trying to make any conclusions here. I'm just making an observation. So
the observation is that they just have no interest in engaging. And I think if you were to pull similar examples from across Europe and in the UK, for example, you would see much of the same thing, that these conversations are just simply not on their radar. And I think maybe that's a wake up call for maybe the conservatives out there, but you know, we'll see. I don't want to get too much in that. We can go down an ugly path with this. I know you probably don't want to go down that path.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's that they just aren't interested in the politics of their adopted country because they're not interested in their adopted country. So
I would argue that they're not even interested in politics in their own country, which is why their countries are the way they are. Now, again, we're getting down a path, but it's like, I don't think it's, and this is where you get into like civilizational spirits, you get into like Spenglerian type stuff, but like there just isn't the programming in their mind to have this sort of, maybe we call it the Faustian spirit, maybe we call it a will to revolution, maybe we call it the sort of rugged individualism and a propensity to organize our own thing. But like, I just don't see that programming in the minds of like your average Chinese person or your and people on our side will be like, oh, they're so collectivist. I'm like, yeah, exactly. But that means, you know, aside from, I guess, the Chinese protests recently, but usually they just kind of go with the flow. Whereas the, let's say the Angles, the Europeans, like there's more of a hair trigger on us. And I think that that's good and bad. And I mean, hair trigger metaphorically, people.
There's more of a bump stock on us culturally.
Of course.
We got like a bunch of scopes on our 9mm and stuff.
Well, one thing just to counter that, when the Ukraine invasion was in its early stages, I walked into a Pakistani-owned shop in Britain, and there was a young guy talking to two older Pakistanis, and they're all three of them are Pakistanis, and I heard one of them saying to the other one that the third one thinks that Russia is pro-Pakistan, and he goes, so he thinks that Russia is pro-Pakistan, and I thought, what the fuck is going on here? Why are three Pakistanis in Britain, and you know, I'm pretty sure they're all born and raised in Britain, and Britain is now potentially involved with a war with Russia, but their concern is whether Russia is pro Pakistan or not. Yeah. Now, obviously, this is not a mystery to me, right? I'm not feigning some kind of CivNat boomer bafflement about this. I do understand it. It just amazed me how blatant it was.
Yeah.
Their concern about the Russia thing is how it pertains to their ancestral country, even though they live here. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting.
You know what I saw? I was in a hotel just the other day, and that's like the only time I get to watch cable TV. So I saw a commercial. I forget, it's for some kind of like sports website. Like maybe it's betting or something, but it was starring John Boyega, the guy from the new Star Wars ones, the black guy. And then they're talking about all the stuff, you know, the joy of being Canadian. I'm pretty sure it was Canadian focused. The joy of being Canadian, the joy of, you know, being watching hockey and stuff. And oh, is that the history of football and about why football is so cool and why it's so important. And then there's this point of the commercial where he says, whether you're cheering for your home team or your other home team. And then the entire thing was about immigrants. The entire thing was, I was struck by how blatant it was. I was kind of a wink to the audience. It's like your home team or your home team, if you know what I'm saying. And so it's like, really, once you cut it away, it's you know, we always ask this question in Canada, which is if World War III did kick off, and let's say there was a land invasion of Canada, how many of them would stand and fight versus how many of them would flee because they don't actually, they can't understand anything that's happening in the Canadian context, or they have something, the programming, like I said, in their mind will always default is, yeah, but what does this mean for my homeland, our people that are connected to that homeland? You know what I mean? So that's kind of what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, it's a very strange situation. I mean, in Britain, we've got this thing, the cricket test. It's a cliche about how to judge whether they are truly British or not. And it's basically which side do they support in a cricket match? It's all kind of ridiculous. But increasingly, the answer is they support their ancestral country. I mean, it's just very obvious. But anyway, yeah, that's a whole other thing. Well, let's wrap this one up now because I'm starting to phase out and fall asleep, even though the conversation is scintillating.
Wait, everyone, Woz is asleep. Everyone start talking shit about everyone on the dissident right.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I'm going to wrap it up. Otherwise, there might be an embarrassing incident where I start talking incoherently and so on. So that would be dreadful. But anyway, this was Dimes and Judas from Blood Satellite. Thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
No, thank you.
No, it was an honor. I really had a great time here. This was fun.
Yeah, seriously.
Okay, great. I'm glad that you agreed to appear. Let me just see who's on tomorrow night. Okay, it's Godfrey Bloom, then Jeffrey Bale and Tamir Baron, then Red Ice, and then Pete Quinones. How is that pronounced? Have I got that wrong?
Quinones.
I don't think anyone's ever said it. I bet if you asked him, he'd say no one's ever said it right.
Okay. All right. So that'll be quite a mix tomorrow night. Bloody hell. But it should be good. It should be interesting. So, all right. Well, I will see you all then. But in the meantime, Blood Satellite, thank you for appearing. I hope you enjoyed it. Everyone else, I will see you tomorrow night. Bye-bye for now.
Cheers.
Bye. We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.